I've got a different story to tell, one that you may have some difficulty in believing. It sounds a bit too much like James Bond in sort of way, but I do assure you it's absolutely true, it really did happen, and I hope I've got enough evidence here to show you that. It all starts a year before D-Day, when the planning was in process. And one of the things that they had to decide was how they were going to support the army when it was ashore. The only way of doing this, they decided, having failed miserably at Dieppe, was to build a port on the coast of France using a sort of enormous Lego system towed across. The point was where to put it. And having got an idea of where to put it, they started looking at the maps and also the offshore conditions of that area. That was the area, and the figures shown there represent the depths of water offshore. Now, they were found to be dependent upon surveys carried out by the French in 1875. There had been no updating since that we knew of. Could we therefore trust them and lay the whole support of the army on an 1875 survey, particularly when you remember that the survey was carried out under those sort of conditions? That is a survey boat of the period. We really did need to do some form of checking. As the authority responsible for charting in the UK, the hydrographer of the Navy set up a small survey unit consisting of two officers. The officer in charge was a senior lieutenant called Frank Burncastle, and I was his junior assistant. Why me? I never discovered. If you manage to find the records, you might find that I volunteered for the job, but I didn't. Well, I was asked to volunteer in such a way that I could not refuse. So I joined him. I went and joined him in a naval establishment ashore in the Isle of Wight called HMS Vectis. Those of you with classical education will know that Vectis was the Roman name for the Isle of Wight. HMS Vectis was in actual fact a block of flats in West Cowes, which had been taken over, and we were given a room on the fourth floor. We were accommodated next door in what had been a hotel. It was all right. That was all of us except for the Admiral in charge and his personal staff. He lived in the glorious, sumptuous surroundings of the Royal Yacht Squadron just over the road. But when I arrived, there was a certain amount of worry going on because a new Admiral had just been appointed. And he came with a very, very warlike reputation. His name was Philip Vian, and some of you may have heard Vian of the Cossack, who took his destroyer 300 miles up a Norwegian fjord and rescued several hundred British seamen from prison ship there. After that, he was promoted admiral, of course, and went to the Mediterranean, where he was in charge of convoys to Malta. And in fact, I had served under him for a short while as navigating officer of one of the destroyers in the escort to one of these convoys. But I never met the great man. That was to come later. I actually met him twice under various difficult conditions. However, we were set up in Cowes, and we were allocated some craft. They were called LCPLs, and there is one of them, the one at the front. Landing craft, personnel, and in brackets, large. Well, I don't know what large meant. They were motorboats, about 10 metres long. And they had a nice shaped bow, and they were fitted with underwater exhausts so that they would make as little noise as possible, because that was going to be very necessary. They were also fitted, specially for us, with echo sounders. Now, for those of you who don't know what an echo sounder looks like, there is one. The arm here rotates, And every time it goes across the beginning here, it triggers off a sound pulse which goes down to the bottom of the sea, comes back up again, and is registered here as a depth of water. The distance from the edge to there being the depth of water. They were little difficult beasts. Sometimes they worked very well, and sometimes they gave trouble. There's a slightly better trace, showing that they can produce remarkably good results. In addition to that, we had a rather strange device called a tortoise machine. Now, it looked rather like that. This here is a reel of wire, very, very fine wire. The drum itself was about this sort of size, and a single length of the wire, which was wound round this drum, would reach from here to Bridgewater. It was a tiny, tiny, very thin wire. And the wire was led from this drum around this sheave here and out over the stern of the boat. This was a measuring sheave, and these pointers here showed how far you'd gone. When you tied a lump of olan on the end of the wire, lowered it to the seabed, and steamed slowly away with the brake there keeping the wire taut, hence the name of the machine. It measured distances very accurately. In fact, we calibrated over a measured mile to make absolutely certain we knew precisely how far we were going. The first operation we did took place on the night of 23rd of October 1943, and it went something like this. We were here, the craft were up there in the Southampton water. They came down to Cowes, picked us up, and out in the middle of the Solent, we rendezvoused with three motor gunboats. We had three craft on this occasion, one for Burncastle, one for me, and one spare. We rendezvoused with three of these, and they took us in tow because we were not very fast, and they were very, very fast. 40 knots was easily their speed. They took us in tow, and we went straight out past the Needles and down there. Now, we'd chosen the 23rd of October because that was a night when there was no moon. That was absolutely essential. And we had to hope that the weather would be good, but we weren't quite sure about that. We went down to as far as there under tow, arriving there just about sunset. At that place, we cast off from the motor gunboats and went south, arriving off the French coast just about midnight. We could only do 9 knots, but that was the best we could make of it. We knew we were there because we were able to use a rather remarkable device which we borrowed from the Royal Air Force, which they called G. It was a radio receiver, and it enabled you to receive transmissions from England. And from those transmissions, you could detect which of these position lines you were actually on, so that we knew when we were running down that which part of the French coast we were going to arrive at. First of all, we knew it was spring tides, because with no moon there must be spring tides. Secondly, high water always occurs at about 2 o'clock in the morning on that part of the French coast, so that we had this advantage, we were able to get quite close inshore. So we proceeded to run lines of soundings. Those are the lines of soundings we ran, the ones shown in red. The mark boat in the middle was anchored to give us a position. We went past the mark boat on these predetermined courses until we got close inshore, getting as close inshore as we possibly could without actually running aground. In the thick dark of a non-moon night, we then proceeded to fix the position of the boat using compass bearings of the houses ashore. We were close enough to see them, even in the dark. It's surprising how far you can see in the dark when you've got to and when you've had a bit of practice. We fixed each of those. At 4 o'clock in the morning, we packed up work. The mark boat, without any further orders, weighed anchor and went straight north. We went straight north and joined up with the motor gunboats just about dawn. I remember it well because I remember looking back from where we'd come, and I could just see the hills of the French coast there, and I thought, gosh, they're a bit closer than I hoped. But from there we went on back home and did the plotting in the afternoon. The plotting was done backwards. That is to say, we started by identifying the houses. That was done using some wonderful aerial photographs produced by the RAF. They flew a Spitfire at 0 feet, and I really do mean 0 feet, along the whole of the French coast with a camera in the side, taking horizontal photographs of the houses. And they produced a wonderful set of photographs. In fact, actually, the first set wasn't quite good enough, and we sent them back to do it again. And they were not very pleased. Not very pleased, but they did. And they produced a wonderful set of photographs, and we were able to identify individual houses and so fix the positions of the inner ends of these lines. Knowing the distance to the mark boat, you could quite easily find where that was, and hence these lines of soundings, which were then sent to the office in London and Taunton and compared with the French chart to see how they fitted. That was the first operation. We did five more, all in various times of no moon. The second one we did was this one. That was actually to the site of the American artificial harbour, Mulberry A. Ours was called Mulberry B, but that was Mulberry A. And you see, the same procedure, but for that one, we took two American soldiers with us. Two Rangers, they were called. Vast great gentlemen, must have been well over 7 foot tall, wearing most beautiful uniforms, covered in badges and polished to the 10th degree. That was fine until we got past the needles, when they both became exceedingly seasick and they lay in the bottom of the boat the rest of the way to France. We pulled them up and showed them France when we got there, and they went back and they returned to England, two very sad and not much wiser Americans. Sorry, but we did try. We also had our own problems. The biggest problem we had was food. Because after you've been at sea all night, you get rather hungry. And the standard procedure for providing us with food was a thermos flask full of hot soup. Now, it was hot at 11 o'clock in the morning. By 4 o'clock the following morning, it was really a rather horrible goo. And we had heard there were some things called self-heating soups. Now, you needed an Admiral signature to get one of them because they were so expensive. So Berncastle put in his first report that he required some of these. Within a minute of his report landing on the Admiral's desk, an extremely senior officer came dashing into our office and said, "These soups, what do you want? Pea, oxtail, tomato?" We got our soups. What they consist of is an ordinary tin of Heinz soup with a firework up the middle and a blue touch paper at the top. And you light the blue touch paper and 2 minutes later you get a beautiful hot tin of soup. And it works. I'm told that when they were first introduced, a very, very senior admiral decided he'd try them out. And being a very, very senior admiral, of course, he didn't have to read the instructions. So he put the tin on his desk, lit the blue touch paper, and luckily for him, he then left the room, because when he returned, his entire office, walls, floor, ceiling, everything, was covered in tomato soup. I told that story in Milverton some years ago, and afterwards a gentleman came up and he said, "You know, I had a similar sort of thing. I was in the army," he said, "and I was driving a tank, and I was given one of these soups. And I put it on the seat between my legs, and I lit the blue touch paper. Luckily, I was wearing flash-proof trousers. But it took another 2 weeks to get the soup off the inside of the tank." Anyway, they were absolutely marvellous. The other thing, of course, was the fact that in those days, the Navy had the rum ration. And when we joined up with the motor gunboats, they passed across a jug full of neat rum. And by the time everyone had had a go of neat rum, you were sufficiently recovered from a night out in the sticks to not worry too much about anything. But we did have other problems. The biggest problem, I think, was probably the weather. And on one occasion, when we were coming back, a gale had blown up from the west. Well, that's not very uncommon, is it, in midwinter? But we found we couldn't go to the Isle of Wight. So we ended up at Newhaven. Went in there. We waited to recover. Berncastle decided that in order to remember what the shapes of the houses were like, he must get back to Cowes immediately. And it turned out there was a car, staff car, going to Portsmouth. So we begged a lift. As we got into it, I found, to my surprise, sitting in the car already was a chap I knew very well indeed. He was in the same term at Dartmouth as I was. So naturally, I asked him what he was doing. He said he was running a small unit of motor torpedo boats out of Newhaven. And he'd been supposed to be on patrol the last night. But there was such an awful gale blowing that he decided not to go. He remained in harbour. Now, he'd been sent for to report to the Commander-in-Chief, and he couldn't understand why. Well, I knew jolly well why. While we'd been operating down here, he'd been supposed to be our covering force in case the Germans came out to take an interest in what we were doing, and in fact, he'd been fast asleep in his bunk. Now, the interesting thing was, what was the Commander-in-Chief going to tell him? How much of what we were doing? I couldn't tell him. I've never discovered what he did tell him, because I can't even remember his name now. But it was an interesting thought, because obviously one of the great things we had to do was to keep it secret, absolutely secret. That is another set of soundings we took on a different occasion. As I say, there were six all told, but there was a seventh occasion when I went across, and that was slightly different, because we didn't take three boats, we only took two. It was decided that it was unnecessary, there was no sounding going to be done, unnecessary for Berncastle to go, and I could do it on my own. What I was going to do was land two soldiers on the beach and bring them back again. The soldiers, Major Scott Bowden and Sergeant Ogden Smith, came on board and we steamed across. But before going, I was interviewed by the Admiral and briefed on to what to expect. His briefing was very short and very simple. He said, there's a gale forecast tonight, but it's just what you want. The noise of the breakers on the beach will prevent the Germans hearing your engines. Well, maybe they would, but you try crossing the channel in a gale in a 30-foot boat. Anyway, we went, and we got there. The second boat was supposed to lie offshore and anchor, but unfortunately her anchor had been washed overboard on the way over, so she couldn't, but she just steamed up and down. We went inshore and landed the two soldiers. This was on New Year's Eve, good, nice, dark night. And as soon as we landed them, we went and anchored offshore. Our anchor was all right, we tied it down. We then said to each other, Happy New Year. But we said it in whispers. Now, we were 2 miles offshore, so it's hardly likely that the Germans could hear us. We shouted it out loud. But it's surprising the way it takes you. We did whisper. About 2 o'clock in the morning, almost two, the two soldiers had done what they needed to do, which was stick spikes in the ground, see how hard it was, take samples of the sand, put it in their belts so they could bring it back for chemical analysis. And they went and measured the height of the concrete wall at the back of the beach. In fact, while they were doing that, they heard some footsteps running down towards the wall and wondered what on earth was going to happen, and they hid underneath the wall. But a German soldier rushed down to the edge of the wall, leaned over, and was violently ill. It was New Year's Eve, and there was a whale of a party going on ashore. From our anchorage offshore, we could see the front doors of the houses opening and shutting as the soldiers went from one party to the next. So clearly, things were going well ashore. We then went in to pick these chaps up. Picking them up was a bit more difficult because by then they were a bit tired, not so keen on swimming off. So we did the best we could, and in doing so we ran aground. And that was really the worst moment of my life, I think, because we really had got to get off and get away. And we managed it with a bit of shoving. But it took a bit of doing, and is not a thing I would recommend repeating. On the way back, we ended up in Newhaven again because of the weather, which is not very surprising. But that was our New Year's Eve trip. The last one we did was the end of January. And on that occasion, somebody must have heard something, because they fired two Verrys lights in the air, to try and see if they could identify us. But they didn't succeed, and we just came back, but we didn't try it again. That was enough, thank you. Of course, when it came to the actual invasion itself, we had to be involved because we'd been there before, so obviously we knew the way. It was my job, it turned out, was navigational leader of what were called DD tanks. These were the Sherman tanks, which you may have heard about, which were made so that they would float. And they had propellers on the back to drive them along, but the trouble was they couldn't see where they were going. So they needed somebody to show them the way, and that was our job. Well, we arrived off the beach at H-1 hour, ready to launch the tanks. You may remember, of course, that the whole thing had been put back a day because of a gale. And there was still quite a nice sea running. And the soldiers took one look at this sea and said, no way are we going to launch our tanks in that. We'll sink. And I think they were probably quite right, because on the next beach to us, they did launch the tanks, and all but two did sink. So it was probably a wise decision. But anyway, it put me out of a job, which I didn't mind much, because I then sat back and watched the battle, which was very interesting indeed. I remember at one stage in the proceedings listening on the RT and hearing the destroyers ashore who were knocking down houses to remove the machine gun nests, which were being rather a nuisance on the shore. And I heard one destroyer come up and saying, finish with that house, which one next, please? This was Gold Beach, and Gold Beach was, as far as I understand it, the most successful of the lot. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was all quiet. There was only a very occasional mortar bomb coming over. So I went ashore because I wanted to report to the beachmaster, who was my senior officer, and who actually I knew because he'd been captain of the destroyer I'd served in the Mediterranean the year before. So we went up to his tent and we opened his bottle of gin, and in a couple of toothpicks we drank a toast to the battle, which was then some 10 miles inshore from us, and it was doing rather nicely. The next morning, the next part of my job came, and that was the beginning of the building of the harbour. Now, the first stage of the building of the harbour consisted of a number of ancient merchant ships which were steamed across the channel and were sunk to form a breakwater. That one there, that was the first one, and you'll see it's out of line with all the others, and that's because I got one of the boys in the wrong position. However, I managed to make up for that with the others as they came. And as each one came, so I went on board and fixed the position of and start making this map. The crew did what crews usually do under those circumstances and have a quick look around. They found that the refrigerators on board were all full of pork chops because nobody knew what the date was when we were supposed to be invading. So they'd had to stock up. The crew had now gone back to England, and we lived on pork chops the rest of the time we were there. And we did very nicely, thank you. A combination of pork chops and tinned fruit. And those are the ships that were sunk in a row. This one on the corner actually turned out to be a great success, because when the gale came, that little area in the corner there was a very nice little sheltered harbour for lots and lots of small craft. And it wasn't really meant to be there, but it worked. Having done that, I took these over to the Chauvet ship that arrived, my little plan of these ships, gave it to them on board, and Admiral Ritchie was there, of course, and I gave it to him. And I then went to the headquarters ship of the Army and gave them a copy of it so that they could start the plans for building the actual harbour itself, the rest of it. And we decided to have lunch alongside the headquarters ship while we were there, and while we were there, I was called to go up on deck. And I went up, and there at the top of the gangway was a press photographer. And that is the photograph he took. Shows one of our boats here, two members of the crew finishing their lunch. This is the mast of the QH Ariel. But we didn't have this, and we didn't have that, and we didn't have these flags and things when we were doing the reconnaissance because we wanted a low profile. But that young gentleman there, that's me, 60 years ago. Yeah, I know, I've changed a bit, but this thing, sort of thing happens. Thank you.